Chapter 9. Clad in nondescript rust-colored garments and a hooded green traveler's rain drape that would remind no one of Jedi robes, Ben shut the locker, hit the button to lock it again, and dropped his lightsaber into a belt pouch. He forced his shoulders down. He'd been edgy since entering the chamber, worried that someone would walk in on him as he changed. But it hadn't happened. He'd chosen the quietest hour of the night, and had chosen correctly. He moved to the loading slot for the laundry chute. It was large enough to accommodate the cloth bags full of dirty clothes, labeled with the names of their owners, that were delivered to the laundry facilities. That meant that it was large enough for children, too. Rumor had it that children couldn't get through the chutes into the automated laundry facilities, but just exactly how they were prevented from descending was a mystery. Apprentices who'd tried it told mutually contradictory stories of greased chutes, robot defenders with electrocuting or tickling attachments on their arms, barrel-shaped chambers that whirl defenders until they were sick, stern talkings to, and extra chores. Ben pulled the lever, opening the drum into which bags were to be placed, and crawled in. It was a tight fit. At 13, almost 14, he was physically just a little large for such a stunt. He used his body weight to roll the drum closed, which opened the chute access immediately beneath him. Bracing himself with arms and legs so as not to fall, he pulled out a glow rod and peered into the depths. "That's a chute, all right," he said. It was a square plasteel hole leading into the depths of the temple. He maneuvered himself to enter the chute feet first, and braced them against the walls. Then he focused his attention on what he was doing, calling on the Force to allow him to dictate the exact amount of friction his feet would experience against the chute sides. And he dropped. He did not so much fall as descend in a controlled skid. As he descended, he could see the edges of the individual plasteel panels that made up the chute. He passed a sensor. What would it be sensing, he wondered. Nothing right now. Siha or some other ally of Jason's would have disabled it. Below him, he saw discolored patches along the chute sides. He increased the friction to slow down and descended past them at the pace of a crawling insect. On one side was a panel with a hinge at the bottom. He poked it as he passed, and it swung freely open, then shut again. Directly opposite it was inset a small but ordinary repulsor unit, the sort one might find on the bottom of a hover chair or hover gurney. He nodded. That made sense. The sensor had to detect density or mass. If something dropped by that was too dense, boys and girls being made of denser materials than bags full of laundry, then the repulsor would kick on, shoving the child into a side chute, probably sending him or her to a holding cell and notifying the appropriate masters in charge of punishment, lectures, and chores. Ben slid on past and picked up the pace. Below was a small square of light, and it was getting larger. The end of the chute. Ben skidded to a silent stop when he was still 2 meters above it. Warm air rose past him, and he heard the hum and clank of machinery. 3 meters below the end of the chute was a smooth, wear-darkened permacrete floor with several gray laundry bags lying in a pile. As Ben watched, a wheeled wagon rolled into view, pushed by a nondescript silver-white droid. The droid picked up the bags, tossed them in the wagon, and then pushed the conveyance out of sight. Extending his senses through the Force, Ben could detect the droid's movement, but he could feel nothing else moving in the immediate vicinity. He dropped the remaining 5 meters, rolled as he hit the permacrete, and came silently up on his feet. In one direction, the droids retreating back. In the other, no observers. Either way, he was looking at an undecorated access corridor, machinery or storage crates piled here and there against a wall. Often there was nothing concealing the drab grayness of the surfaces. The glow rods mounted in the ceiling, widely separated and offering only low light, created an even more dismal appearance. Per Jason's instructions, Ben turned right and dashed silently in that direction. Soon enough, the main corridor made a 90-degree turn to the left, but there was a door in the wall there. Heavy metal with an imposing-looking durasteel rim, it was labeled Emergency Evacuation Access. Use only in times of emergency. Temple security will be alerted. Only in times of emergency. Well, the whole galaxy was facing a time of emergency. Ben shoved at the metal panel that constituted the mechanical opener, to be used in times of power failure, and he felt his shoulders hunch up again as he unconsciously anticipated an activated alarm. But none came. Siha had done her job well. The door swung smoothly into a very short permacrete corridor, unlit, and there was an identical door at the far end 5 meters away. Ben responsibly shut the first door behind him, making sure that it latched into place. He might be disobeying the wishes of his father, but that was no excuse for exposing the Jedi Temple to possible intrusion by an enemy. The Order had enemies, like the woman his father kept mentioning, Lumia. The second door also opened without activating an alarm, but sound washed over Ben anyway, and warm, heavy air. It was raining, individual drops pinging off a surface over his head. In the moments before his eyes adjusted, he could see the lights of traffic streams to his right, but they were broken up, somehow disconnected. He doused his glow rod and shut this door, too. When his eyes did adjust, he found that he was in a strange durasteel framework, long and narrow like a corridor. The floor and ceiling were metal sheeting, but the sides were mostly vertical metal bars with very narrow gaps between them. Through the gaps to the left, he could see only dressed stone, probably the temple exterior. To the right was darkness and Coruscant cityscape. Quietly, he moved toward the end of this pseudo-corridor and could feel it sway slightly under his feet. And at the end, its purpose became evident. There he found a stand-up set of mechanical controls, several sets of wheels to spin. It took him only a few moments to work out their functions. This was a telescoping access. One wheel would cause it to stretch out to its maximum length, and as it extended, the metal bars all along its length would thin out. Other wheels allowed the controller to change the angle at which it was attached to the temple, up, down, right, left. Thoughtful use of the controls would allow its operator to place the end at some lower level on the temple building, or stretch out toward a traffic lane, enabling rescue speeders to pick up those fleeing the building in time of fire or invasion. Ben spun the wheel that opened the end door. He stood out on the exit ramp and looked down. Below was the exterior wall of the temple, nearly featureless at this point, sloping slightly downward into the depths of Galactic City. All he had to do was descend, find transportation to a minor spaceport 400 kilometers away, present the false documentation that had waited with his new clothes in the locker, and board a run-down excursion transport bound for Almania. Easy. Kuat System. Love, Commander.
Establish communications, Lando said.
I really think, Leia said, you're letting this whole captain thing go to your head.
Lando gave her a long, thoughtful look.
You're right. Dearest Leia, friend of decades, noble Jedi Knight, please do one more favor for this old, old man before his vital spirit leaves his faltering body.
She gave him a long-suffering look.
Forget I said anything.
Ready to broadcast? No, not that.
I meant, come live with me. Tendra would understand, I'm sure of it.
She sighed.
Yes, Han, you can shoot him.
Wouldn't think of it, her husband said. If I shot him now, I'd never learn just how deep into trouble he could talk himself.
Ready to broadcast? Now, Leia said,
and pressed a switch on the comm board.
"This is Beskat Offderman, Master of the Love, Commander," Lando said, "approaching the errant Venture. Do you read, Venture? Over."
"Errant Venture flight coordination here, Love Commander. We read you."
On Lando's display, the distant view of the errant Venture, the galaxy's sole star destroyer to bear a lurid red paint job, faded and was replaced by the face of a young red Twi'lek woman. Narrow orange and yellow piping had been artfully applied to her leku, and the top portion of her clothing, visible at the bottom of the screen, suggested she was wearing a black evening dress rather than a ship's uniform.
"We have a reservation and landing authorization. Love, Commander, and the all-clown squadron of fun."
The woman glanced down, presumably at a data screen.
"So you do. You're cleared for landing."
Her voice trailed off, and she looked again, obviously not prepared for what she'd seen.
"In the flag hangar. I'm sending a guidance beacon on your frequency now."
"Thank you."
The Twi'lek smiled, and the screen went dark.
"What's a flag hangar?" Lando asked.
"The Venture's an old Imperial Star Destroyer," Han said, shrugging.
"Commissioned as the Virulence."
"I know that," Lando said.
"Well, except I forgot its original name. Whenever an ISD served as the flagship for a task force or fleet," Han went on, "the commanding admiral would be aboard with his own quarters and his own private hangar, which was called the flag hangar."
"Ah." Lando nodded wisely.
"So, Han, old buddy, how long has it been since your academy education has come in useful?"
"Now," Han said, "I'm going to shoot him." Corellian Exclusion Zone. Anakin Solo, Command Salon. In the holocom transmission, Luke looked as serene as usual. But even so, Jason could sense that the Grand Master was impatient, distressed. Mara, beside him, didn't bother to hide it. Her expression was a mix of worry and anger. Without preamble, Luke said, "Jason, where's Ben?" Jason gave him a confused look.
"I take it from the question that he's not where he's supposed to be."
Luke nodded. "That's correct. I notice you didn't answer my question directly." Jason felt a flash of anger. How dare Luke assume he was hiding something? The fact that he was did not enter into things. Luke needed to treat him with more respect. It was a lesson he had to make sure Luke learned. That would be soon, he hoped.
"Do you see conversational ploys in every discussion, Luke?"
The way he spoke the Grand Master's familiar name was just short of insulting.
"All right, then. Let me be absolutely clear. I don't know where Ben is."
That was the truth. Lumia was monitoring Ben's mission, not Jason. Even if Jason had been lying, he was sure Luke would not have been able to detect it. Jason had been proficient at concealing his true feelings and emotions for a long, long time. He'd grown even better at it under Lumia's tutelage. Luke was silent for long moments. Finally, he said, "I'm sorry, but we're worried. He disappeared from the temple, and we can't find any sign of where he's gone."
"Can you feel him in the Force?"
"Yes. But that doesn't mean he's safe, just that he's alive, somewhere, and not close." Jason sighed.
"He's too old to be running away from home like this. My guess is he resents the fact that you took him away from me. And you know that suggests you were right. If he's going to be doing things like this, he may not be mature enough to be my apprentice. At least not yet."
Luke and Mara exchanged a quick look. It seemed like a neutral exchange, but Jason could read it as though it were a large text news feed. They were thrown off by his admission that they might have been right all along. He exulted in his power to position their emotions. Mara said, "Has he communicated in the last couple of days?" Jason shook his head.
"I received a text message from him explaining some ways he planned to make Luke move his feet in sparring. That was the last I heard from him. Of course," he added, "if he's run away from home and can find a way to get off planet, he'll probably come here, to me. If that happens, I assume you want me to send him straight back."
"That's correct," Mara said. "And even if he doesn't show up there, if you find out anything about where he might be..."
"I'll transmit it to you instantly," Jason promised.
"Thanks, Jason." Luke waved to something outside the range of the holocam view, and he and Mara disappeared. Jason smiled. Causing people to think and feel what he wanted them to, even without resorting to the Force, was becoming easier and easier, even with difficult subjects, like the almighty Luke Skywalker.
Kuat System, Errant Venture. Love Commander followed the Pulsar Skate into the flag hangar, with the two X-Wings bringing up the rear. Waiting at the doors leading out of the hangar was Booster Tarek. The old man certainly wasn't diminished by age, Han decided. Burly and gray-bearded, he floated around on a hover chair as massive as the front end of an airspeeder. But he stood up out of the chair as the skate's boarding ramp came down, and Mirax dashed down it. He might be too old to walk long distances, but he was certainly not going to be caught sitting down for a reunion with his daughter. Lando, Han, and Leia were toward the back of the greeting line. Wedge, Iella, and Miri also embraced the old man. Han and Leia shook his hand. Corin, Booster's son-in-law, was last to approach and did the same, his rueful expression suggesting he still hadn't quite forgiven himself for coming to like Booster. Booster finally sat again and fixed a glare on Corin.
"But you didn't bring my grandchildren."
Corin folded his arms.
"They're scattered to the four corners of the galaxy on Jedi business. Not my fault."
"Humph."
The old man fixed his stare on Mirax.
"Your husband still can't do simple math. You can't scatter two children to four corners."
Mirax's grin grew broader.
"Jedi think that everybody can be divided into fractions. Come on, Father. We really need to talk."
They settled into a private conference room only a few paces from the flag hangar. The black, gleaming sideboard had been set out with finger foods, alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinks, and sealed sabacc decks with holographic images of the errant venture on the backs of the cards. Most people present settled for the food and alcohol-free beverages, but Miri took a sabacc deck and practiced shuffling, stacking the deck, and palming cards. Leia watched the sophisticated card sharps' techniques for a few moments before turning her attention to the others.
"So,"
Booster said, and pointed at Han and Leia.
"Everybody in the galaxy wants to arrest you two, except the Hapens, some of whom want to investigate you, and some of whom just want to kill you. Are you going to get the venture blown up?"
"What's the matter?" Han asked, his voice taunting. "No sympathy for someone everybody is chasing?"
Booster snorted.
"Good answer."
Leia knew that he'd been a smuggler before she had been born, and had been sought for his crimes by both Corellian security and the Empire. Corin's father, Corsec Agent Hal Horn, had arrested him, and the man had spent years on the mining prison of Kessel. These days he was reformed, legitimate, about as much as Han Solo.
"All right," Booster continued. "What is this all about?"
"I'm sure you know all the public facts about the Corellia GA war," Wedge said.
I'm equally sure you're running odds.
Booster nodded.
When your retirement ceremony was broadcast, odds went to 37-1 for total conquest of Corellia. Unless the Bothans come in, at which point it goes to 14-1 for a negotiated conclusion, with the Bothans selling the Corellians out and getting the Rancor's share of the deal.
Wedge's face twitched.
Right. Anyway, the public records don't talk about the fact that there are odd, unexplained variables at work here. The pressures that have brought this war into being are unambiguous, easy to identify. But there's additional string-pulling going on that is harder to bring into focus.
Such as, Lando said, efforts by different groups that would like to take Han and Leia out of the equation. Take the assassinations of the Bothan politicians on Coruscant. If they were done by Corellians to bring the Bothans in, why haven't those agents also targeted major figures like Cha Neothel to deprive the GA of some of its strategic strengths, or Jacen Solo as revenge for all the Corellian prisoner-taking? Things aren't adding up.
Wedge said, My instincts tell me that if you bet on all the forces lining up to keep the Bothans out of the war failing, you'll make a good return on your bet.
Hold on,
Booster said. He spoke to the right arm of his chair.
Log that tip.
Logged,
the chair said, its voice that of a female protocol droid. And then there's the whole thing with ghosts appearing and persuading previously rational people to do very bad things. Leia said, That strongly suggests a Force user. A Darksider, in all likelihood, if the goal is to help war happen.
If there is somebody pulling strings, Han said, that rotter is probably on Corellia or Coruscant. That's where most of the puppets are dancing. And I'm talking about people like Cal Omis and Dirk Gedgen being puppets.
We sort of stowed away on the Antilles Horn rendezvous with you, Booster, Leia said. But on the flight out here, she glanced at Han, we came to the conclusion that the Errant Venture would be an incredible resource for gathering information. Park it in the Corellian system, where there are thousands of restless military personnel. Provide gambling and entertainments. People get drunk. Talk more freely.
Han added, And it's not as though there'd be a big financial loss. Thousands of restless military personnel, like Leia says.
Booster snorted.
You think I'm so old I don't notice financial opportunities anymore? Princess, I applied for access to the Corellian exclusion zone the day it was established. The GA has been sitting on my application ever since.
Leia resisted the urge to take offense. Somehow, when Booster used the word princess, he made it a comment about a spoiled little girl rather than an acknowledgment of her former title. But she refused to rise to the bait. She simply nodded.
I'm glad you have no objection. So now all I have to do is get your application approved.
Booster gave her a dubious look.
Because you and Captain Bloodstripes there are so well-loved by the government now.
Leia matched him stare for stare.
No, because Jacen Solo swings a big lightsaber with the blockade forces, and if Luke Skywalker tells him that letting the Errant Venture set up there is a terrible, terrible idea, Jacen will probably accelerate its approval so fast you'd think he slapped a hyperspace engine on it.
It hurt to speak dismissively of her own son's powers of critical thought, but it had for some time been obvious that Jacen was not entirely logical when it came to his relationship with Luke. Jacen resented his uncle and balked at Luke's advice. Painful as it was, Leia now found it useful to exploit the fact.
Oh!
Booster thought about it for a second, and then was distracted by more of Miri's prestidigitation.
All right, girl, you can stop it. You're hired.
Miri froze in mid-shuffle and looked at him, wide-eyed. Huh?
You were applying for a job, right?
She shook her head, bewildered.
I was practicing. Mom says it's an area where I'm weak.
Booster turned his glare on Iella.
Meaning you're better at it than your daughter?
Both women nodded.
All right, then,
Booster said.
Iella, you're hired, too.
Iella smiled.
Only if we get the approval for Corellia. But if we do, Miri and I will work for free.
Hey,
Miri protested.
Well, for tips.
Done,
Booster said. He turned back to Leia.
And done. Drop the word to your brother. And while we're waiting for the approval you're so confident about, slap some paint or fake fur on those two famous faces of yours, and enjoy yourselves aboard Errant Venture.
He smiled almost benignly.
Spend lavishly. Tip your hosts and hostesses.
Coruscant, Zorp House Apartment Tower.
You're sure? Mara said.
The Nemoidian male gave her a half-bow, appropriate to an acknowledgement on Coruscant, but insultingly deficient on worlds where the precise angles of such gestures spoke volumes about one's intent and attitude.
I am absolutely sure, he said,
his speech flavored with the musicality of his native tongue.
As ever, I cooperate fully with the Jedi Order, with the Galactic Alliance Guard, with—
With anyone who pays, Luke said. And you have been well paid.
I have been well promised, the Nemoidian answered. Not so much paid yet.
Then show us,
Mara said. The Nemoidian pressed a sequence of buttons on the control panel of the turbo lift. Its status display switched from hold to one. Then the numbers began climbing, as the turbo lift did. Mara felt the car accelerate. But turbo lifts in habitation buildings as lavish as this one had small inertial compensators to make rapid ascents and descents comfortable.
When you contacted me, the Nemoidian said, you asked for comm records from the quarters of your suspect, and for other anomalies in the security recordings.
Mara nodded. Weeks earlier, meticulous police work, tracking from the site of the murder of Jedi Master Trasina Lobi, had led to this building and the realization that the Sith Lady Lumia was one of the murderers. Even more unwelcome was the fact, gained from examination of the quarters, that Lumia had strong ties to the Galactic Alliance Guard. That revelation had thrown more suspicion on Jason, the Guard's operational commander.
The investigators of the GAG took everything from her quarters, the Nemoidian said.
The turbo lift came to a halt at the 288th floor. Its doors opened onto a broad hallway, lined with walls that gleamed like crushed gemstone. The Nemoidian stepped out, and the Jedi followed.
They also took records from the security office. Records, privately owned datapads, legally registered blasters, and restraining devices— A servitor droid. Half-eaten food.
Yes, yes. Luke didn't sound impatient, but he wouldn't have interrupted if he weren't. But you found something anyway.
Of course. We had backups on all the security recordings, and I found that the suspect's most frequent communication through the building's comm system was to herself, from one installed unit to a second installed unit.
Mara shrugged.
A common practice in intelligence circles. She would have sensors attached to her comm, measuring noise, resistance, and so forth, to determine whether the unit or the comm lines were tapped.
Ah!
Into that one word, the Nemoidian squeezed a tremendous amount of self-appreciation.
Not so.
He led the way along the glittery corridor, past two sets of residential double doors, and stopped at a smaller, unmarked door. He held up a datapad and keyed in a number. The door popped open with a quiet whoosh, indicating that a seal had broken, and warmer air washed over the Jedi. The Nemoidian pulled the door open.
The room beyond was dark until glow rods above blinked on, illuminating a narrow chamber lined with stored goods, cleaning solutions, deactivated mouse droids, bins of replacement electronic parts.
"You see, 3 hours ago I plugged new comms into her comm jacks and sent a message from one to the other. It never arrived. Yet sending a message from the second to the first, that one did arrive."
"Ah."
Mara offered him a slight smile, the first sign of approval she'd given him.
"And here is where the interception was taking place."
"I did not touch it," he said. "I remember your words about traps, bombs, poisons."
He offered a shudder.
"I have left it for you."
"Where is it?"
"Before I tell you, I wish to leave, to have a head start in case you trigger an unfortunate event. And before I leave, I wish to be paid, for if you are dead, I can never be rewarded for my efforts."
Mara exchanged a glance with Luke. He nodded, confirming that he, too, had detected no sign of deception in the Nemoidian story. Luke pulled a cred card from his pouch and handed it over. 30 seconds, he said. The Nemoidian half bowed again.
"In anticipation of close timing, I left the turbo lift on standby."
He gestured upward to the top of the shelving directly above Luke's head. And then he turned and ran. Luke snorted, amused. Mara leapt up, and with a little propulsion boost through the force, landed seated on the top shelf. What the Nemoidian had found was obvious. In his search, he had removed a ceiling panel that provided access to a series of data cables and water pipes. Spliced into one of those cables was a commercially available data pad. Mara brought out her electronics tools and got to work on it. Luke remained at floor level. "Is it a trap?"
"Of course."
With gloves, tongs, and tools, she already had the exterior panels off the data pad.
"The battery compartment has a smaller-than-standard battery, plus an explosives charge, just enough to destroy the data pad and blow your hand off."
Belatedly, she felt a little twinge of sympathy, and looked down at her husband.
"Oops. Sorry, farm boy."
Luke glanced at his new hand. "That sounds like a small charge from someone as dedicated to overkill as she seems to be."
"It is."
She returned her attention to the device.
"That's because it's backed up by poison. Trihexylon beneath a very thin layer of spray-on sealant. How nice that I didn't touch it. I'd be dead. The bomb would go off. The rest of the poison would go gaseous. The explosion would breach the air duct. The duct would draw the gas in.
Economical."
"Got it. Diffused. Now."
She set the poison and explosives package aside, then swiftly cabled in her own data pad. After a brief analysis, she said,
"A simple intercept and redirect. Communications from 30712 Alpha to 30712 Beta are intercepted and redirected to Neg 3413.
"Basement level 3? Is that bedrock level?"
"Yes, or close to it."
Mara disconnected her data pad, restored the panel over Lumia's pad, and placed the explosives and poison package into a self-sealing container. Then, tools and container in hand, she dropped to the floor.
"I think we need to see another set of quarters."